Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, producer Jonah Primo here, and welcome to Principle of Charity, where we inject curiosity and generosity back into our conversation on big social issues. This is part two of our conversation on whether or not our ethnic heritage matters. Now, in part one, our host, Emile Sherman, really teased out that question. So if you missed that, I really encourage you to press pause and go back to that last episode, have a listen, as it will contextualize what you're about to hear. For everyone else, today Lloyd is meeting our guests on the couch to ask some personal and edgy questions. Enjoy.
Great. Thank you, Emil. Ben and John, as you're probably aware, in the Principle of Charity, we're trying to get an understanding of the other before instinctively rejecting it. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's going to be substantive difference between the two of you, but nevertheless, let's maybe test your listening ability. And John, I'm going to start with you. What are the best arguments you've heard from Ben for the importance of connecting with one's sort of ethnic and racial heritage?
Well, I just think it's an entire celebration of life and provides for a complete human being, nothing short of that. I agree entirely with the proposition that history is something that enriches human life. Cultural diversity, cuisines, stories from our past and from our relatives, as well as our friends and connections culturally and otherwise, religious, potentially, and academic even, all serve to contribute to what makes an individual a whole thing. And sexuality, of course, has been a theme throughout as well. All of those factors make an individual complete. And what I have come even better to understand in today's conversation with Ben's eloquence is embracing the importance within individual diversity that stems from a history, often that is shared with people who are closer to us. And as those rings of the onion resonate outwards to those people that we connect with even more distantly, perhaps on a podcast, there are still commonalities which extend to being human, to being alive. And that's a source of rejoicing. It's a source of shared experiences and also celebrating differences. And we briefly talked about diversity, but it's not something that is to be dismissed too readily. I guess multiculturalism has carried us enormous baggage within Australia and elsewhere. But the very idea of diversity, I still think, resonates with most people. And the idea of listening to the alternatives view and trying, yes, to really embrace the principles of charity and reflect on alternative paths that may be different and that may even cause offense to some, but that make up the complex world that is being a human being. And not one thing defines us. And Ben's made that point as clearly as you could possibly make. Some days he's gay and some days it doesn't matter whether he's gay. And, you know, some days I'm Jewish and some days it doesn't matter. And today I've been very academic, which I regret. I would have much rather been a more complete human being, actually. But the opportunity will no doubt present and I'm applying for a gig with Ben right now to appear on one of his stage shows.
Ben, let me ask you, what are the best arguments you've heard from John or elsewhere, actually, for why we should be extremely cautious about caring about our ethnic and racial heritage?
You know, when I listen to John speak, I'm one of those people who didn't do any of the sciences in high school. And one, I deeply regret that. And two, actually wish I had John as a science teacher when I was around. No shade on the science teachers at my school when I was around. But when you talk about being so academic today, I actually feel like you've told stories of wonder. And I think sometimes when we talk about science or the way in which science is framed, people think of stats and data and hard investigation, and it is all of those things. But I also hear the joy of, did you know? And when you were talking about that cell, that tiny cell, when you unravel the information, it would span a meter long, telling us so much about who we are. I just think stuff like that is absolutely, one for me, just awe-inducing. And I think that it does tell a story that we don't often tell about our shared heritage, which is, you know, not going to be around forever. You know, everything's around until it's not. And that this particular chapter of us even existing is really fleeting and precious, and that these commonalities that we have that science expresses and science reveals is something that we need to be talking about more. You know, that alphabet soup of the four letters, like how extraordinary that it is, those four little markings that can create such variations, and how kind of wonderfully perplexing that that's the reality of how we're made as well. So I've just sat here in just curiosity and gratitude that you've explained all of that. I'd love to hear more.
It's exactly what you said, Ben, because the joy of discovery in science, which, as you can tell, I skip to work every day because of the thrill that I experience in making discoveries and possibly helping people with their health in the future. But it's actually in the detail of those differences that make that discovery process. Revealing secrets of Mother Nature is one of the most joyous activities you could possibly experience. And doesn't that resonate perfectly with the detail of differences between us individuals? You know, as a medical man, you meet a new patient, they come to you asking for help, but you ask them details about their life to understand why they're there and what's really brought them to the clinic today, and come to understand them as a whole human being, not just as a disease. Oh, that's cirrhosis over there. You know, when we're doing rounds, we used to talk, oh, that's cardiac failure. It's like, oh my God, it even sounds offensive as I say it right now. No, that's Mrs. Jones. She's a grandmother and she's suffering from pain in her chest. There we go. And so anyway, I'm just trying to say that the details in the molecular biology of life resonate with the details that make individuals individuals, and that's where we can celebrate both diversity and commonality.
The concept of ethnic heritage, I mean, I struggle with this because it's often defined as the inheritance of something good. It would also seem to me that ethnic heritage sometimes exaggerates, omits, it thrives on ignorance. So ethnic groups say they have a remarkable culture, every ethnic group probably, but they also forget some of the nasty things they have done, or the fact that within those ethnic groups there is a strong history of prejudice and continues to be prejudice. How do you deal with that in your own ethnic group when you confront that? Do you still say, I am proud of being Jewish or Chinese, and then you sit there and you're listening to this racism or prejudice or whatever you are seeing or has occurred in your particular group? I mean, how do you deal with that? Ben, I'll start with you.
Well, there's an ongoing joke, especially amongst like second generation Asian Australian diaspora, when we're subject to racism, often we'll say amongst ourselves, because Asian people can't be racist. Mm-hmm. And of course, the irony there is we have seen firsthand the racism that our people, especially our parents, especially older generations, have perpetrated, or the way that they speak about other people. So this idea that victimhood only is a set state, I think is something that we all need to resist, because history shows us we can be victim and perpetrator at once. when it comes to even the intra-Asian racisms. You know, we talk about Asian Australia as a monolith that has copped racism within Australia, but one of the reasons I really loved seeing a play called White Pearl by Enchuli Felicia King is that all the leads on stage were Asian women. But if you have any knowledge of those Asian people's heritages and histories, you know things are about to blow up because they're having certain conversations about certain things that are booby traps and tripwires because of their ethnic heritage. So I think going back to what we were talking about before, you know, the dark side of ethnic pride can manifest in very, very violent kind of chapters in history as well.
I guess I would extend it briefly by simply pointing out that as individuals, we have to be very careful about how much we identify with a given group. We've agreed furiously today that we are all individuals and that we are incredibly diverse. And sometimes we are putting this particular aspect of our personality, culture, or history forward. And other days, that's not even an issue. And it depends on context, as Ben so beautifully put. The point of my comment is just simply to reflect on the fact that as complex individuals, sometimes we agree with the group that we've said that we are part of. And other times it's like, actually, I can't subscribe to that. I really don't agree at all. And then there's a really difficult challenge, which is, okay, well, are you in or are you out? How important is this point of difference to you as to separate yourself far enough away to be outside of that group and all the pressures and the forces that especially young people feel to comply with the social groupings and pressures?
Ben, is it always beneficial? And I mean, a lot of ethnic groups, in fact, if I think about most that I can think about, will often claim victimization of some sort at some point in history, or they will say, we were victimized. Is it always beneficial for ethnic groups to claim victimization?
I think sometimes it's just purely accurate in terms of the scenario that that we're describing, and sometimes the lines between who's the perpetrator and who's the victim is very, very clear. And at the same time, you know, the conversation that we've been having is about how many multiple truths we can hold in our head. It's like, is that the end of the story though? You know, and I think it's worth being a storyteller, seeing things as chapters and different iterations of our story that are incredibly complex and sometimes contradictory as well. And I think there have probably been instances where we've all been in arguments where we're both the victim and the perpetrator at the same time within the very single dynamic. So in terms of claiming victimhood, I mean, one of the lessons that we learn in storytelling or in trying to make interesting stories is that there's no such thing as a perfect victim, and I don't think there's an obligation to be either.
And you don't feel that at times a sense of being a victim, I'm also just thinking more personally, can lead to not sort of reclaiming your power. And in some way it sort of just feeds on itself. I know for myself, you know, when I'm feeling very sorry for myself and things have occurred, which occurred yesterday, like I got a tire, then my other tire went, and I was like, man, I just like things are, and I'm feeling powerless and miserable. You know, it sort of feeds on itself. And obviously at a broader social, political level, economic level, this is substantive. I mean, how do you get out of that sense of identity? How do you move beyond it?
It's about perspective and proportion, I think, isn't it? I think part of me would want to endorse the ability for everyone to luxuriate in self-pity sometimes. Very important, very kind of fortifying feeling to have. But then at some point, you're right, Lloyd, there is a danger in luxuriating in that pity for too long because then if you only see yourself as the victim and luxuriate in that feeling too long, you're only telling one story about yourself as well. And what that single story then precludes is the possibility that you might be able to do wrong yourself against others. And that's when it's deeply dangerous.
I have a perspective that reflects Ben's, but also I think you might find interesting, and it is this concept of victimhood, which I've always rejected in my own life, perhaps it's an ego strength or something that I just don't feel, a victim. But I wanted to make the point as follows. You don't feel like you've lost something if you never had it in the first place. And so people, you know, twist their heads to the side and they go, wait a minute, John, you don't feel like a victim. You were denied grandparents by the Nazis.
Mm.
And you don't think you're a victim? You know, would they not have enriched your life amazingly and beneficially? The answer is, of course, yes. But you don't know what you lacked in the first place. And this goes back to, for example, inherited deafness or diseases. If you were born not hearing, do you really miss hearing? If you were born lacking paternal grandparents, do you miss paternal grandparents? So victimhood is even more complex than just that luxuriation that Ben's eloquently described. It extends to your perception of what might have been as well, and that opportunity cost and opportunity loss that is actually very important in so many aspects of our lives.
I feel like I have to present the conservative viewpoint here, and just as it's the principle of charity, presenting the alternative and just staying with the area of victimization. I mean, there are conservative critics who would say, the higher you are, and I want to link this to truth now, by the way, the higher you are on the oppression ladder or perceived oppression ladder, the more you are seen to be telling the truth. How does that resonate with you? Ben, I'll start with you.
Look, I'm getting my head around processing it because I think people who are oppressing don't usually think of themselves as oppressors in the first instance.
That's true.
And I guess the other thing that comes to mind is, I guess, the definition of oppression, which I think is inextricably linked with power. Now, if you are talking about having great power, then the capacity to oppress becomes much more frictionless and easy, doesn't it? Because you do own the story, you do own the narrative. And I think here in Australia, when we think of where ownership of the press lies and where those kinds of seats of power are, you do have easier channels through which you can prosecute the case and persecute, arguably, others as well. And for those people who have been the target of media campaigns, smear campaigns, you know, there's very little recourse or avenue you can use sometimes in order to have a rebuttal.
Both of you are in the public domain. I've been listening to you now for about an hour, but longer than that. You strike me, both of you. I mean, if our audience could see you, let me tell you what, you know, John and Ben look like. They smile about 70% of the time, 80% of the time. Often when I'm meditating, I realize I'm not smiling and how tense I am. So my smile, and this might just be a moment in time. Maybe you're having a good day. Maybe this is your public face. I have no idea. But you both strike me as incredibly happy people at the moment anyway. Tell me, what triggers you to be less charitable to others? John? Let me hear the shadow side of yourself.
Insincerity and lack of humility, a lack of compassion and generosity of spirit, those things sincerely piss me off and deeply trouble me and drive me into a furious mess inside whilst I'm still smiling on the outside. I mean, I figured since a child, given the choice between smiling and snarling, smiling is kind of easier. And I think there's even physiological evidence that it does good things to your dopamine and other messes with your brain. So what the hell? Smile away. I also had a senior leader who often reflected on exactly what you did, which is, oh, John always seems to be smiling. And let me say that doesn't mean that what's going on inside my head is any less rigorous or any less thoughtful. It's just an expression that makes people feel, I guess, reflect back in a way that is positive. And so I think that the default should be to smile. I would encourage you always to have a gentle smile on that relaxed face, Lloyd, as you meditate blissfully into nirvana. And I think that that's
no nirvana when I'm meditating. Trust me, it comes much later in the meditation. But when I set out, there's no nirvana.
I think you'll be levitating before you know it.
Yeah. When I dive into the ocean, I get nirvana straight away. Interestingly enough, Ben, let me come to you. What triggers you to be less charitable?
When there is pride in ignorance. And I think this is coming to what John was talking about before, when there's an absence of humility and there is instead pride, but there's nothing to be proud of. And when people are so, so firm in their beliefs with so little evidence in a way that's presented to obliterate other people, I find that really, really frustrating. Or when people are presented with data, evidence, facts, and still reject them. The inability to, I think, change your mind when presented with another way of seeing things that's convincing and actually based in fact, I find really incredibly frustrating.
And Ben, for you personally, if you think about the last 10 or 15 years, where has there been a sort of more transcendent change in your view on a social issue or on yourself?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, when you're talking about transcendent change, my thoughts immediately went to my nephew. And I don't know if this is what you're looking for, because it's not a social issue as such. Mm-hmm. But I think 3.5 years ago, when my nephew was born and I became an uncle for the first time, and I do have step nephews as well. But when Cohen was born, I think I saw the world differently, and I think the idea of the stakes changed. You know, these were not necessarily like abstract conversations about climate scientists that we were talking about. I was projecting into this young kid's future who I care about and love very, very much. So I feel like he's been a game changer for me in a lot of fundamental, profound ways, actually.
Okay, good stuff. I'm going to move on. We have in this section of the show, we have a game called Net Positive, Net Negative. You have to be pretty brief. All you have to say is net positive or net negative, and you need to give one or two reasons why. We know this is not scientific, so I'm sure you're just going to in fact, this is the instinctive part of the show. So are you up for it? Are you both up for it?
Game.
Let's go for it. John, I'm going to start with you. IQ testing, net positive or net negative?
Net positive, because it allows us to stratify people with their strengths.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Ben, Ricky Gervais.
Net positive, because I like his early comedy, and even though I really disagree and am disappointed by a lot of his later material, I think the conversations those things are provoking are really important.
Okay. John, animal lab testing.
Essential, net positive, because we have a choice. Either we do not test specific medical promising therapies in a species that is not our own, and I know that will cause a lot of people problems, but as a human doctor, as in a medical doctor looking after humans, I prioritize humans, and that's my choice, and animal testing is a part of that.
Okay, thank you. Ben, British royal family.
Net negative. I'm sorry. Think of what they have done throughout history, you know, and for what? So we could have some joy at, like, gossiping about these people who we have no relationship to. I just think it's a waste of brain cells that I need to think about them at all.
Okay, good stuff. John, cosmetic surgery.
Okay, depends on the context. If someone's got a cosmetic abnormality.
No, let's just say no.
Oh, for beauty. Net negative.
Why?
Because it's expensive, it can cause risks, it's a massive industry, and it's self-absorption and it's populism and it's marketed. I hate it.
Ben, bombing of Hiroshima.
Oh, my gosh.
Good one.
I think net negative. In that I am convinced by that stage because, look, I might have my history wrong, but the avenues towards ending the war were already starting to become inevitable. And that kind of level of death, I mean, when I've been to Hiroshima as well, it's an incredibly sobering place to process that level of immediate death. And I'm not really sure that can ever really be completely comfortably justified.
John, William Shockley, and for others who might not know him, the sort of co-inventor of the transistor, I think he brought silicon to Silicon Valley, won the Nobel Prize for Physics, but also a massive supporter of the eugenics movement. Net positive or net negative?
Net positive. Eugenics, it has to be remembered, had a very, very valid origin, which was to seek the improvement of the human species. And it was an academic area of pursuit. Charles Darwin's cousin was one of the very, very first to propose and I think define the word. There were eugenic societies all over the world, in the USA, in Melbourne. There was a major society for many, many years, and only really when Nazism took it to its evil ends did the word take on a horrific and now unutterable context.
Okay. Last one, Ben, The Australian.
Oh, you mean the newspaper?
The
Easy, net negative. besides their arts coverage, and I think they've got good business pages, and they used to have a really great media section that I actually subscribed to The Australian for many years. I think in the last decade, it's become an incredibly destructive force in public discourse, in climate denialism. It's wasted time with our ability to actually do something about the climate crisis in which we find ourselves. And you might think, oh, yeah, little lefty rabble-rouser saying that. Talk to former editors of that masthead. Okay. They might say similar.
Let me stay with diversity and inclusion, because it's a big area in the corporate world. It's a big area in the NGOs, no doubt, in all the organizations you work with. We had a guest on the show a while back, Chloe Belderi, African-American, who does a lot of diversity and inclusion training and is a massive critic of it. And her view, certainly within the United States, was that it often doesn't work because some of the participants, especially white participants, sort of feel attacked. And because they feel attacked, it makes them more defensive. I'd like to get your views on that. John, I'll start with you and then move to Ben.
I think you're right. The problem is that DEI has been politicized extremely now, and indeed weaponized by two extremist sides. The core, I think, wish to embrace and bring in otherwise discriminated against groups is a good one, but the way that it's realized, again, back to the details, the devil is in the details. And you're absolutely right. It's been weaponized by groups that should not have done such things, but then it gets complicated and laws get involved and executive parties get involved at universities and organizations, and people criticize. And with social media being what it is, everything explodes very rapidly, and then it becomes a feeding frenzy by the press. Why wouldn't they want to cover an argument? That's the fun of what the press does. And so on it goes. I don't know how to recover the common ground that I think is something that we could share, we could embrace. Mm-hmm. But at this stage of the politics of it now, the lines have been set, and it's very difficult to see how we can disentangle that in a mature and, compassionate manner. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Ben, your views and maybe also comment on critical race theory.
Well, in the first instance, I would say that we're having a slightly different conversation here in Australia, is my sense. And I think that the weaponization around critical race theory, around diversity, equity and inclusion is present in Australia, but it's not at the center of the conversation like it is in the United States. It's not really something that you can win political votes with like in the United States, I don't think most Australians are actually thinking about this stuff, unless I'm completely out of touch.
No, I agree. I spend quite a bit of time in the States. I actually agree with you.
I'm pretty confident that if you went to most Australian households and you asked them what they think of critical race theory, most people would have a blank look on their face.
What is your view on it, though?
Look, I think let's start with diversity, equity, and inclusion, because there are training programs and modules, including one that's really great that's provided by a trusted organization like SBS, that goes into workplaces, and most of it is modeled around a conversation, which is, here's the conversation of how Australia came to be. Here are the gaps in terms of how that history has affected the way that modern workplaces are established. And this is some data that we'd like you to think about. Now, do some programs go an extra step and become incredibly prescriptive about what needs to be done from then on? Absolutely. And I think that's when you get backlash. What I think needs to happen is you need to present workplaces and people with power the information and then get them to do their homework because they know their workplaces best. What sometimes happens is you present people the data and everyone agrees. And I think in Australia, for the better, we have an attitude of like, fair enough, like that's actually a problem that these people, based on their demographics, have been historically and systematically excluded from the workplace. What we need to back that up with is, what do you do next? Now, some people are incredibly allergic to quotas, and I understand why, but that is one mechanism. Other people are incredibly averse to targets and goals and metrics of what you should hit. And that's fine, but that is another mechanism. And I think there needs to be, I don't know, because we're not having this conversation in isolation of other places that are also trying to address these systemic problems, we should be having conversations with New Zealand and Canada and similar multicultural countries to be asking, well, where have they gone right and where have they gone wrong? And in fact, they can look to us. Where have we gone right? Where have we gone wrong? So for instance, the Canadian screen industries actively engage with the Australian screen industries to ask, how have you got your First Nations storytelling on screen so robust over the last 50 years? Because it wasn't always that case. And the way that Australia has done it is through funding, is through initiatives, through homework. It doesn't just happen by accident. But that's one model. Does it apply to the Canadian model? That's something for them to think about. When it comes to critical race theory, I think I actually need to do more reading on that myself, because I think that also is a bit of a Rorschach test for Americans. I think critical race theory has been used as a buzzword to mean a lot of things that I think academics would agree that it is or that it isn't. But when it comes to, for instance, a massive New York Times investigation about the historical kind of violence against black populations in the United States, the fact that that history won't be taught in some schools because of what people call critical race theory, I think is alarming. You're denying people an understanding of their own stories.
John, I mean, you are writing articles, generating tons of research in the public domain. I mean, are you afraid around generative AI that it sort of, that it has the capacity to generate studies that potentially quote you, quote other people? You know, they've been just sort of, we're starting to see the amount of disinformation attributed to analyst groups or even in the consulting world to the big four or five consultants. They've never written that report. Are you worried that this could occur with respect to yourself? And how do you see that as a scientist and a writer?
Well, thank you. It's an incredibly serious and profound issue and very confronting. I published a book called Flesh Made New that focused especially on fraudulent medical claims and in the stem cell field especially. But Carl Power and I researched that extensively, and that book really focused on some of the fraudulent people that were purposely purporting to make discoveries that ended up being absolute rubbish, and some very, very famous cases like Paolo Macchiarini, who's currently in jail in Sweden, and another researcher in Japan, Obakata, both of whom fell from grace from the very highest levels. But more specifically, you mentioned AI, and This is a really profound and important and serious issue that is only just being grappled with right now by academic institutions. You've seen the most senior members of Stanford, now Dana-Farber, Memorial Sloan Kettering, either going down because of scientific fraud, just manipulating data wrongly, or they're drilling down back 20 years ago in their PhD theses and finding that they didn't cite appropriately their source and being criticized for those kind of things. So AI is both mining data and also generating rubbish. And we even have a word for it, of course. It's the hallucinations of ChatGPT or Bard these days. You know, you ask a question of these generative AI systems and they actually provide you with citations, and some of those citations do not exist in the real world, and yet they appear. Unless you drill down, you actually go to find the primary source, they don't exist. So even AI can hallucinate. And when you think of it, of course it would, because it's only as good as the database that it mines. And so if you provide it a million times by various ways data that says this is a reference that is in the real world, even though it's not, well, it exists in the virtual world, and so a generative AI is going to mine that and pump it out. And you'd be also aware that the New York Times has just had a major court case established where they are suing almighty hell out of generative AI technologies for mining their content. And for creatives like the present company included, this is a major threat to the very existence of the creative life and the creative world. If you're generating text out of your mind and then that's being repurposed by generative AI to create anything that it's purporting to create spontaneously through complex mechanisms that we only beginning to understand, then there's stuff there that it kind of has a word that's called theft.
Ben, for those people who have actually transgressed, meaning they've either been prejudicial, discriminated in different ways, let's assume they've actually done some nasty things, should they be redeemed? And if so, when you are in your social groups and you are hearing a critique of them, let's assume they're still alive, do you encourage redemption?
I think generally, yes. And I think it depends on who we're talking about and what exactly they did, because I think proportionality is kind of the thing that I want to hold close when we talk about redemption. Because I think in the age of social media and, you know, in the dying days of Twitter/X, one of the things that was problematic, and one of the things I found problematic about it towards the end, is that the volume and the intensity seems to flatten out and it all kind of becomes the same no matter who has transgressed and what they've done. I think a lot of the attention is often warranted, but in terms of the intensity, not always. So I think, like, my the core of my being is always about redemption, rehabilitation, and what comes next for a human being. But I also think it depends on context.
Yeah, thank you. And on that note, I want to thank both of you. It has been, I don't know if this is genetics or cultural heritage, but I mean,
maybe both.
Be in the company of people who are so smart, so articulate, and very happy, you know, at the moment anyway. It has been an absolute privilege. And just want to check with both of you, where do we find you? Where do our listeners find you? Ben, maybe start with you.
Look, you can find me by Googling my name, and I can't promise that nefarious things won't come up. but I'm currently on the back page of The Good Weekend. You can watch Wellmania, a show that I helped make on Netflix.
Good stuff. John, how about you?
Well, I certainly don't have the social presence that Ben has, but I guess you can search on my name, which is a unique made-up name from a list in Hungary. So RASKO is relatively unique, and my lab is represented online, and my foundation is represented online, called Cure the Future, but also the institutes that I work for, Royal Prince Alfred Hospital and the Centenary Institute at the University of Sydney, are all ways to track me down.
Beautiful. Emil, any comments from you?
Yeah, just to say thanks so much. I learned an enormous amount. And these questions come from things I've been battling with. And I really feel like I've resolved some of it through the help of you both. And certainly the infectious smile is as important, I think. It's the sort of attitude with which one approaches questions often, you know, produce a result more than just the sort of brute intellect. So thanks so much for joining and for all your time. I know it's been a long chat.
It has. Maybe that's a compliment, the best compliment you can offer, but let's do it again sometime.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please rate us and leave a review. That is simply the best way to support the show and help it grow. We'll see you soon for more Principle of Charity, but first, a word from our partners.
The Ethics Centre is an independent not-for-profit that for over 30 years has advocated for a more ethical society. Through all our work, we bring people together, create space for difficult conversations, and encourage all to live and act according to their values. Check out our website for free access to articles, podcasts, and videos that unpack the complexities of everyday life at www.ethics.org.au.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.